Welcome to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. The military history of the United States' involvement in World War II covers the war against Japan, Germany, and Italy, starting with the December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. During the war, over 16 million Americans served in the United States Armed Forces, with 290,000 killed in action and 670,000 wounded. Highest priority went to the defeat of Germany in Europe, but early on, the war against Japan in the Pacific was more urgent after the sinking of the main battleship fleet at Pearl Harbor. Today we'll hear the stories of three Minnesota soldiers who served in World War II in Europe, in the air, and on the ground. But first, it's time for Generally Speaking, a weekly message from the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, Major General Rick Nash.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. I would like for us all to take a moment to reflect on the sacrifices made by that generation of men and women who have come to be known as the greatest generation. Historians estimate that approximately 16 million Americans participated in World War II. Of that number, almost 300,000 never returned home. Another 670,000 were wounded. And an even more sobering number is the 10 million lives that were lost in one of the saddest chapters of human history known as the Holocaust. Almost 1,000 veterans from the greatest generation are taken from us every day. Their contributions to peace and prosperity in the world can never be forgotten. Our GIs were a shining beacon of light and hope when Europe was darkened by fascism. Names and places from that war has become part of our everyday vernacular. Eisenhower, Patton, the Bataan Death March, Normandy, Corregidor, Bastogne, Bradley, and Berlin. All of these faces and places conjure up imagery so striking that it has been ingrained upon the American psyche. Ingrained because of what the American service member did for this nation, Europe, the Pacific, and for the world. To our World War II veterans, I salute and thank you.
Thank you, General Nash. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. Joining me now, we have two World War II veterans who both flew on B-17s in Europe in World War II. First, let me introduce Bob Clements. Bob, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're a young man these days. How many years ago was it that since you were on a B-17?
Well, the last time I flew on one was July 12th of 2015.
So you're staying close to that aircraft.
Yeah, we're staying close to it. But I finished my bombing missions on September 12th, 1944.
And you were a navigator.
Correct.
Was that by choice, Bob?
That was by choice, yes, sir.
Can you tell me when did you enlist?
I enlisted in November of 1942, about 5 months after I graduated from White Bear Lake High School.
And where did you go for your training?
The first place I went was to Jefferson Barracks, Missouri, for Army basic training because it was part of the Army. And that's where I did the basic training. And then I went from there to Washington University in St. Louis, and from there to pre-flight training in Houston, Texas, and then from there to Hondo, Texas, west of San Antonio for advanced navigation school.
And back in those days, the Air Force was part of the Army, wasn't it?
Correct, yeah.
They call that the Brown Shoe Army Air Force.
Yes, that's right.
And how long did the air training take?
Well, I finished my training in February of 1944 when I was 19 years old, so I was a second lieutenant when I was 19.
And then you were assigned to the 15th Army Air Corps?
Yeah, well, we went to Sioux City, Iowa to meet my crew. And we didn't know where we were going, whether we'd go to England or the Pacific or to Italy. But they sent us to Italy.
And the key to that whole thing was you were assigned to a B-17 crew.
Correct. 10 men.
10 men. And we'll get back to you in just a moment. We've got another gentleman with us today, Vince Parker. Vince, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you.
And you're also from Minnesota?
Yes, from Ortonville, Minnesota.
Out on the west side?
Yes, right on the border with South Dakota.
And when did you enlist, Ben?
Well, the day the bombs dropped on Pearl Harbor, I was out northeast of Ortonville hunting jackrabbits. I had just turned 16. It never dawned on me that I would ever, ever be caught up in a war. But my father had a meat market and a slaughtering company, and he lost his help to the war. So I had to quit my senior year in high school to go to work for Dad. I never did graduate from high school because of the war. I was scalding hogs and butchering cows and carrying quarters of beef that weighed more than I did. I could hardly wait to get in the service. I enlisted. I wanted to be a fighter pilot. Every kid in America in those days wanted to be a fighter pilot. I enlisted, and I went into the service in February of 1944, and I flunked the physical. They offered me limited service. I could drive trucks. I could type this and that. And I said, I don't type and I don't drive. He said, I'm sorry, soldier. And he marked me.
Limited
they
duty.
They sent me to gunnery school in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Okay. And when did you find out you were going to be assigned to a B-17?
Well, when I was in Las Vegas, they assigned me to a gunnery and they sorted me out as a tail gunner on a B-17.
Now, how do they choose the guy that's going to be a tail gunner, Vince?
Well, my lower ball turret gunner, if you know where that is on a B-17, it's that turret underneath. That Ogle, the ball turret gunner, and Parker, the tail gunner, the pilot put a string across the radio room, and he asked us to go under that string, and he picked Ogle to go into the ball because of the way he responded to that bending over there, so it wasn't very scientific. The pilot had to pick the gunners. There were only three professional gunners on a B-17. The tail gunner, one of the waist gunners, the lower ball turret gunner, were all professional gunners. Their only job was gunnery.
So was that pretty cramped quarters going back in to be a tail gunner?
Yes. Every movement was a measured movement with all the equipment that you wore, with armament and steel helmets and parachutes and oxygen mask and all that communication. Every movement, as they say, was a measured movement.
So if you had claustrophobia, that wouldn't work very well.
That wouldn't work very well, no.
Bob, I want to come back to you. Can you tell us about a B-17? What were the capabilities and what was the crew size and so forth?
The crew was 10 men, and we carried 6,000 pounds of bombs, almost 2,800 gallons of 100-octane gasoline. And normally in our group, we carried 800 rounds of 50-caliber machine gun shells for each machine gun, and there were 13 machine guns on the B-17. Everybody shot at least one except the two pilots. I shot two, one on each side of the cheek up in the nose. And so we had a lot of armament aboard. So took about a whole mile to get airborne.
So it was loaded down and it took a while to get up in the air.
Yes.
How far could you fly and still get home?
Well, you could fly, they would say 10 hours. If you flew with 10 hours, there would only be fumes left in the gas tank. The most I ever flew was about 9.5 hours on a mission. Yeah. But most of the missions were 6 or 7 hours.
Now, you had oxygen on board, and you.
Yes.
At what altitude did you fly then?
Put the most of the bombing was done between 22,500 and 27,500. Put the oxygen on at somewhere between 10 and 12,000 feet on the way up and took it off on this way down at the same altitude.
Now, Vince, on those rides to and from your bombing places, it must have been a little cold up there and a little quiet and lonely in the back of that airplane.
It was 50 below zero in the wintertime in Italy when I bombed in November, December, and January. But we had heated suits and heated booties and heated gloves. In fact, as I had heated gloves, and if I had a malfunction of my machine gun, I would take off the glove, and I had silk for my hand so I could work with the guns, with something so I wouldn't freeze my fingers.
Was it a little lonely back there in the back of the plane?
Yes, it was, but we had communication with each other. We talked to each other a lot. The navigator would call for oxygen check, and we would start at the tail, and everybody would report in to make sure they were okay.
And they did that periodically throughout the flight?
Yes, yes.
So at least you didn't go crazy back there.
No, no.
Now, I read somewhere that you had your parachute on most of the time.
I was the only guy with his own escape hatch back there.
Did you ever have to use it?
Well, I went back there a few times, and I went to that little door, and I pulled a couple red pins and turned a handle, and I could roll out of there with my parachute on. And no, I didn't have to bail out, but I came close a few times. One day on an oxygen check, do you mind if I tell you a story or at this point about a call?
Let's, if you could hang on to that for just a minute, Vince, we'll come back with that story. We've got to take a short break. This is Minnesota Military Radio. We're talking to Bob Clemens and Vince Parker about their roles in World War II aboard B-17s on Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Chaplain Buddy Nguyen with the Minnesota National Guard. Army Medal of Honor winner and Vietnam veteran Chief Warrant Officer Frederick Ferguson said that we are blessed to live in America. This is a nation where you can go as far as you want to go, and you are able to go as far as your God-given talent will allow you to go. This Thanksgiving, let us remember the words of the doxology, which remind us to praise God, from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, all creatures here below. Happy Thanksgiving from the Minnesota National Guard.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking today to two B-17 World War II veterans, Bob Clemens, who was a navigator, and Vince Parker, who was a tail gunner. And before we went to break, Vince was about to tell us a story about the oxygen checks. Vince, can we go back to that?
Sure. Well, every once in a while when you're at high altitude and the flak is exploding and terrible things are beginning to happen, they would call the crew. My navigator on my crew would say, oxygen check. Starting at the tail, we would all report in. Well, one day the radio man didn't answer. So we went around again, and one of the waist gunners didn't answer the oxygen check. So the pilot called me and he said, Parker, what's happening back there? Well, I could look past the tail wheel, through the waist, into the radio room, and Faust, the radio man, was out, unconscious on the floor. And the waist gunner was trying to get oxygen into him. His line had been severed. So Clancy called me, and I told him that. He said, we're going down. He dove from 28 to 12,000 feet over Vienna to get oxygen-rich air.
To try to save your man.
To save our guy. On the way down, he said, prepare to bail out. Well, I was always ready. I always had my parachute on, especially in a situation like that. When you dive over 175 miles an hour in a B-17, you go to he might lose control, or an aileron, or lose control. There was a point in the bomber. We cruised at about 150 with 6,000, the bombs Bob mentioned, 12 500-pound bombs. So on the way down, he said, don't bail out unless you hear the emergency bell. Well, we pulled out, and we saved Faust. He was never the same after that. He'd been out too long. And he said, don't bail out unless you hear the emergency bell. Well, after the war, I was reading a manual, and in there I found out that the bell didn't reach the housing in the tail. I never would have heard the bell. The ball turret guy never would have heard the bell. It's on the records. That was the guys would have waved goodbye to. So it was just one of those things.
So you were lucky he was able to pull out of that dive.
And, yes.
Because you would never have heard the bell anyway.
No.
That's a pretty exciting story. Bob, I want to come back over to you. One of the things that I read about is the flak. And the flak was pretty darn heavy when you were getting to the area you were supposed to bomb, wasn't it?
Oh, it was just terrific. Just so heavy. On my eighth mission to Budapest, Hungary, end of June 1944, we were scheduled to bomb at 23,000 feet. We went in at 23,000 feet, and there was a layer of clouds above us and one below us. Above us, the German bombers were dropping bombs on us, and so the colonel decided to circle the target and go down to 13,000 feet and get under both layers of clouds. Well, while we circled for 20 minutes, the flak was just intense. It just 20 minutes doesn't sound like very long, but it seemed like a lifetime to me. We got down to 13,000 feet, and on the bomb run, we lost number 3 engine, hit by flak. So when we came off the bomb run, we dropped our bombs, and we came off the bomb run. We couldn't keep up with the rest of the group. So then 4 German fighters jumped us. 1 ME-109 and 3 FW-190s jumped us. They got number 1 engine, so now we got 2 engines. We're at about 10,000 feet, and some of the Alps there are 11,000 feet or higher. So the pilot wanted me to plot a course so we could go around that. We threw out most of the stuff, including I threw out the the bomb site, which I caught a lot of flak from when I got back to the base. But we did make it back, had 2 men wounded just superficially on the leg, not really serious. But when we got back, the airplanes had about 300 holes, about 2 inches in diameter, and 30 holes from the German fighters' 20 millimeter cannons that were about 6 inches in diameter.
So they air conditioned your fuselage.
Yeah. The amazing thing to me was that ground crew had that airplane ready to go in 2 weeks. They patched all those holes and put two new engines on. That's what impressed me about the war, that the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, the Air Force, everybody worked together, and they all did a whale of a job, including the people back here at home.
We're talking to Bob Clemens and Vince Parker, two World War II B-17 vets on Minnesota Military Radio. Vince, I heard a story that on one mission you were on the way back and your aircraft was so beat up you had to find a place to land. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Well, yes, we went to a target called Hagen's Home. We never got there. All of a sudden, we were at high altitude. Everybody was at their battle stations on their oxygen masks. Suddenly, the ship began to shake like a dog out of water, violently. I didn't know what was going on. But all of a sudden, there was a boom, boom, and the aircraft stopped shaking. A propeller couldn't be feathered, and it tore off the crankshaft, sliced through the waist, cut off a part of my horizontal stabilizer, that little wing right next to me in the tail. And the pilot called the navigator and said, "We can't get home. We've got to find a place to land. We can't make it past the base." We landed in a pasture, Yugoslavia. He made a tremendous landing. In fact, he got the DFC, a Distinguished Service for Flying Cross, for that landing. We came to a stop. We opened the door, and the 10 guys rush out, and we were in partisan country, enemy country. And a partisan boy on a bicycle with a German machine gun across his back cycled up to my engineer, and he grabbed him, and he shook him, and he said, "Cigarette, Joe?" Cigarettes were the coin of the realm. He didn't smoke, but they could use it for bartering with. And now we were in enemy territory, and we had to get out of there. So the radio man called for help, and a C-47 flew in. That's a twin engine. We called it the Jeep of the Sky. It came in, it circled, and it landed. It was below radar, real close to the ground, and stopped. The door flew open, and there was a beautiful nurse there and a doctor. 10 guys rushed the aircraft and yelling, "She's mine." She said, "Get in here." So we all piled in. We went back over the Adriatic, back to our base where we'd come from. We landed. I went back to the tent that I lived in. And our navigator didn't go, our waist gunner didn't go on the trip. He'd been bounced for a photographer. You had things like that happening. And he was in the tent crying. He'd heard that he'd lost his crew. And at a reunion years later, I reminded him of that. I said, "Remember when you were crying, we came in, you thought you'd lost your crew, and you were crying?" I said, "You know why I was crying?" I said, "Because you'd lost it." Well, he said, "No, I knew where you had your whiskey behind the Colt rack." And right. I knew it was worth money. They gave us two shots of whiskey after every mission. They should have given it to us before we went up.
So he was pretty happy to see you back, but then he lost that extra ration of whiskey, didn't he?
Yeah, right. Now I'm going to see how long. Now that mission was to Hagen's Home. Let's see, here was on March 28th. We were forced landing in Yugoslavia. We flew in Amazing Maisie, that was the Nose Art. 4 hours and 30 minutes was the duration of that mission.
It was a long 4 hours and 30 minutes,
yeah,
wasn't it?
We took wild rides every once in a while like that.
All right, Vince, I'm going to talk to Bob for a second, but when I come back to you at the end of the segment here, I want to hear that little song that you were singing on that video. Bob, you knew when you went to war, when you went off and deployed to go to Europe, you weren't coming home until the war was over and you won, didn't you?
Well, either till the war was over, until you flew the number of missions that you had to fly. That was what you had to do.
And you flew 50 missions?
50, and so I could come home. But then I was getting trained to go to the Pacific in a B-29 as a engineering officer. So I'm glad that thing ended when it did. I'd have been in the Pacific at the end of September 1945, and of course the war ended in early August in the Pacific.
But the big difference with a World War II, all of our military knew they were going, and we were going until we finished this thing.
That's right. That's right.
That's a major deal. And you, I also read by the end of the war, by the time you were flying those 50 missions, there were lots of aircraft, lots of ammunition, lots of parts.
Yeah. Well, there were 2.5 million men in the Air Force at the end of the war. We lost about half of the B-17s that were built. They built about 12,600 of them. Half of them were lost.
Well, it was a long time, a long war, and you guys did a great job. We're looking forward to hearing some more of your stories. When we come back in the second, third segment, we're going to talk to Joe Kovar about his time with General Patton in the General Patton's Third Army in Europe. But before we do that, Vince, can you share with us that little song that was at the end of that video?
Well, I'll try to remember it and what I remember of it. A little ditty that we sang in the 15th. You must remember this, that bullets don't always miss. Somebody has to die. The odds are always too damned high when the flak goes by. Now 110s and 210s knocking at your gate. Come on, bombardier. Salvo, don't be late. The target's passing by. It's still the same old story. The 8th gets all the glory. The 15th has to die. The odds are always too damned high when the flak goes by.
Very good. Thank you, Vince. That was Bob Clemens and Vince Parker talking about their days in World War II on B-17. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Minnesota Military Radio Network. Stay tuned for more and follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.
Welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons. We've been hearing the stories today of three Minnesota soldiers who served in World War II in Europe, in the air and on the ground. And we're going to get back to those interviews in just a moment. But first, it's time for the Commissioner's Corner, a weekly update from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Now here's Commissioner Larry Chaletot.
We commemorate the 70th anniversary of the formal end of World War II, a conflict that tragically claimed millions of lives across Asia and the Pacific and stretched several months beyond the war's conclusion in the European theater. We salute the American servicemen and women of that greatest generation who answered the call of duty in the Pacific. We remember those who endured unimaginable suffering as prisoners of war. We honor the ultimate sacrifice of more than 100,000 U.S. service members who laid down their lives in the Pacific Theater to defend our nation and the advance of the cause of freedom. To them, and to the 16 million Americans who served in the Second World War, those who are no longer with us, and our proud veterans today, our debt of gratitude can never be repaid. We live in freedom because of their brave service.
Thank you, Commissioner Chaletot. For more information, please go to MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. We've been talking today with a couple of aviators from World War II, and now we're going to the ground game. And our guest that's joining us now is Joe Kovar, who served with General Patton's Third Army. Joe, welcome to Minnesota Military Radio.
Thank you, sir.
Joe, are you a Minnesota native?
I certainly am. I was born in Owatonna, raised in Anoka.
All right. And
graduated from Anoka High School in 1943. 2 weeks later, I was in the Army.
How'd that happen so quick, Joe?
Well, back then, we were all patriotic. We wanted to go in. We had kids leaving class at 15 and 16 and joining the Navy.
And after all, it was a world war, wasn't it?
People were anxious to get involved. We wanted to belong.
Joe,
I felt kind of guilty going down the street if you didn't have a uniform on.
Joe, I don't think today's citizens understand that a world war means everybody's at war, and there's rationing, and there's everybody's participating in manufacturing equipment and ammunition. And
that's right.
It was a full effort, wasn't it?
Yes, certainly was.
So where did you go for it? Where did you? What?
They sent me to Fort Benning, Georgia, which is the infantry school, and my basic training was infantry training. And as young 18-year-old kids, they sent thousands of us down there, and all of a sudden, you had no milk, you had no cold water, you had nothing. And I'll tell you, it was kind of fun the first few weeks. But when we came out of there 13 weeks later, we were tough. We had learned a lot. We were ready to go.
good shape. You knew how to, good stamina, knew how to shoot weapons.
You could run for miles carrying 50 pounds and you never got tired.
And you were young back then.
Yep.
You look like you can still run a little bit today, Joe.
I do.
That's good. Now, when you got done with your training, what was the next assignment?
Well, after that, they sent us to Boston. We were going to become engineers. Those of us that had enough high school good marks, they call it, I guess. And then when the Germans broke through at a place called El Alamein in Africa, they called up everybody that had infantry training and said to report to New York City, you're going to be shifted right down to Africa. Well, we got down there, but in the meantime, Patton had broke through down there and stopped them, so we didn't have to go. So they shipped me to South Carolina and put me in an infantry division. And the infantry division was the 26th, or the Yankee division, which was a Boston group, and it was made up mostly of older guys from Boston, and we were treated, again, like junk, you know, as young kids. There was about six or eight of us were sent down there. And that's where we joined the infantry, and we had to adapt and work our way in with those guys.
And you ended up proving yourself because you had a little background in...
Well, we had to. We proved ourselves. When we got in combat, we pushed those older guys right out. Those that weren't dead were demoted.
And it didn't hurt to be a Golden Glove champ before you left, did it?
Well.
Big edge for you. So did you stay with that outfit for the rest of the war?
Yeah, I did. I left them. I got wounded once, and I had to go back once. I got sick, and I had to come off the line. And you have to request that you go back to your old unit, otherwise you don't. And I was just dumb enough to request that I go back up front again, and it was front line. We were right front line. There's nobody between us and the Germans. And
this was part of General Patton's Third Army?
Yes, we were. We were in the 26th Division. When the bulge started, that's when we got in his Third Army. We were up at a place called Nancy, which is in northeast France. We thought we were going to spend the winter there. As a matter of fact, Patton set up his headquarters there, and everybody was taking it easy. They thought the war was going to just sit in limbo for the winter. And that's when Hitler broke through that bulge and started it in December. Well, what happened was we had no warning at all. They ordered us within an hour to be on trucks. And we were. The only thing they issued me was an overcoat and a pair of gloves. And no heavy equipment, no warm socks. We still had the old leather boots. And when we got up there, it was about 20 degrees. They dumped us off. It was dark. Snow, 2 feet deep. We were in the Ardennes Forest. And be comfortable, boys. Dig in for the night. You know, we had no food. We had nothing. And it was kind of miserable. The first thing we did, all of us, was throw our gas masks away and put our feet in the bags that they came in. To try to get them warm.
Warm.
And that's the truth.
So it was you were out there in the middle of the winter trying to fight the Germans in the Battle of the Bulge and not dressed properly and no food. And
well, yeah, we adapted to it. Your food was K rations, which came in a box the size of a Cracker Jack box.
Good stuff, huh?
And you got either a red, a green, or a blue one, depending upon what it was. And all it was a package of condensed meat or eggs or something, a few crackers, 4 cigarettes, and some toilet paper. And that's what was in a K-ration. And they'd throw you one and say, enjoy. You know, that was it.
We're speaking with Joe Kovar on Minnesota Military Radio about his time in World War II with General Patton's Third Army. Joe, I understand that you had a guardian angel during the war.
I certainly did. There's a thing called a Schmeisser machine pistol, which is still and was the fastest firing weapon ever made by man. That thing would shoot something like 30 bullets a second, and they would spray with it. They'd just go prrt and spray across. And twice I came through the woods with a man on each side of me, and they sprayed us. They got killed. I didn't get touched. Figure that one out.
Somebody must have been helping you.
Somebody had their hand in front of me guarding me. That's just one occasion. I had a lot of chances where I was saved like that. But that's just one of those things. And nobody can tell me they don't exist because I saw them.
Joe, what was your thought about General Patton? How tough was he? And
General Patton, of course, we know from history now that he was a great leader. He was a winner. And he was very tough. But he was the greatest egotist in the history of the world, I think. He would stand sideways when he talked to you. I talked with him 10 feet away. He stood sideways, pulls his jacket open so that his pearl-handled pistol showed, and he'd like to show that off and brag. He'd turn sideways and show it to you. And he was just terrible. And the thing that endeared him to our hearts was we were going on the attack one day in the Ardennes, and he said, "I want everybody to leave their entrenching tools." That's a little shovel that folds on your back. He said, "I want you to leave those behind. You're not going to stop long enough to dig in." We got the greatest shelling of the war that afternoon and lost 57 men killed in my company. We were just wiped out. That's where I lost my hearing. We lost, you can't believe the butchery. They were laying there everywhere. And we didn't like Patton very well after that.
Because you had no way to dig in and avoid it.
No, you couldn't dig in. There's no way without some. You couldn't even scrape. If you could just scrape a little bit of a hole to get into, it had to be almost a direct hit to hurt you. Otherwise, the shrapnel flies through the air and you're gone. I took a shell burst right above my head that took my hearing, and it must have been a concussion grenade because it didn't hurt me except took my hearing. I haven't heard since. And it's just been one of those things. But I had friends laying there butchered, their guts wide open, excuse the language, and begged me to shoot them as I walked by. Could you? I couldn't. I couldn't shoot them. And we were lucky to get out of that woods. That was the worst shelling of the war, they said.
There's a price to be paid for freedom, isn't there?
Yeah, that's just one of those things. But we lost all kinds of men like that over the war. There was two of us came home from the original company, so it tells you what we ran into.
It pretty well took care of your company, didn't they? Yep. Hopefully more of them were wounded than killed, but you lost quite a few. Joe, I heard that you had quite a time getting across the Rhine River.
It was. When you think about it, it was kind of fun. The bridge at Remagen was there, and they took us over there, and they were using the bridge to take their heavy equipment across. So the engineers put rafts across the river, and you kind of bounce across them, and there was a big bull rope across the river. Biggest bull rope I ever saw. It must have been eight big ropes twisted together. There was a jeep on each side of the river that held it tight. And you held onto that. And as you went across, you got wet because you bounced. And you'd get water. It'd come up like this.
Wintertime, correct?
Well, it was February, early February, right yeah. After the Battle of the Bulge, which ended in January. Or it might have been the end of January. I'm not sure.
So you got across the river and you're all wet and no place to...
We got across the river, we're all wet, and we run into women and kids shooting at us. Hitler took people and put them in the lines. He had old men, women, kids, and we had to shoot back at them. Can you believe it? The guy is nuts, and that's what he used. He used everybody he could get on that line. And if they didn't go up there, he had them shot. So that's the way they ran that thing.
Joe, we're going to have to take a short break. When I come back, I want to talk about the concentration camps that you came across.
Okay.
But before we go to break, I understand you've got a little answer for Vince's song. Do we have an infantry song you want to sing?
Well, it goes like this. Oh, the infantry with dirt behind their ears. The infantry, they drink up all the beers. But the Air Corps and the Navy and the Corps of Engineers could never whip the infantry in 100 million years.
Very good, Joe. That's Joe Kovar, a member of Patton's Third Army during World War II. We'll be back with more with him. This is Minnesota Military Radio. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Minnesota Military Radio. I'm your host, Tom Lyons, and we've been talking to Joe Kovar about his time in World War II as part of General Patton's Third Army. And Joe, before we went to the break, that was quite a song you sang for us, by the way. Thank you. But we were talking about Battle of the Bulge and how you went into that, and your men weren't prepared with winter clothing and so forth, but you got through the winter. How beat up were the soldiers after Battle of the Bulge and you came out of that?
Well, let me tell you something. The German soldier was tough because they were all on drugs, as it turns out. But the weather that we had to fight, no hot food, no warmth. We were scared. We were being shot at. There was no hope there. If you stuck your head above that hole, you're going to get shot at. It didn't look very good for us. Plus, how would you like to be in that hole, in those conditions, freezing, and everybody had diarrhea? Now think about it. That's a terrible thing to say, but you know what? Think about it. It was horrible. We had to put up with that kind of conditions, too.
And your feet were freezing?
And I'll tell you what, our machine guns were freezing up on us, and we were having all kinds of problems. We ran out of ammunition for our bazooka, and I had to go out and kneel in front of a tank one day without any. And I'll tell you what, you get so scared that after a while you overcome it, and then you do stupid things. We all did. I got 17 medals, and I'm not a hero. I don't call myself a hero because all the heroes are buried over there. But everybody was that existed and made it over there. It was that tough.
Joe, can you tell me about when you first came upon the concentration camps?
When we hit our first concentration camp, it was in Germany, and I think it was probably in like about March of 1945. We came to this concentration camp. We saw these barbed wire fences that were about 20 feet high and three or four tiers deep and guard towers. And we came up there, and we wanted to go in and couldn't get in. Everything was locked. So they brought up about three or four tanks and put them side by side and ordered them to just roll right through it, and they did. They tore the fences down, and then we poured in there. The first thing we saw was sticks down there with heads on them. And as we got closer, we could see that it wasn't sticks at all. It was human live beings that were starved to death. There was nothing left of them. I don't think they weighed 50 pounds, and there's a head on top of it. And we tried to feed them. We couldn't. They all died. And then we went inside and we saw the slaughter. There was bodies. I saw one pile of bodies, I swear. It was as big as a football field, 20 or 30 feet high, all naked, all starved to death, all beat up and tangled and run over by bulldozers. And it turned us to the point where we would have butchered any German soldier we could have caught, but they all ran out the back door when we came in. Eisenhower ordered the camera crews to come in and film that because he said 50 years from now, nobody will believe us what we saw here.
So you documented it, you filmed it, you photographed it.
Gentlemen, it was so horrible. You could smell a smell 10 miles away from the camp of dead bodies. And then the German people had the guts to say that they didn't know what was going on in there. They certainly did. And it was just unbelievable. They had no food. Their beds were nothing but boards. If you were lucky, you had 10 pieces of straw to lay on. They had very little clothes. They kept them naked.
How many camps did you come across, Joe?
Four.
And you said each one was worse than the one before?
The main one was, I think it was Mulchausen or something like that. It was a camp where they were gassing the Jewish people. They didn't do that in every camp. And a lot of them, they just shot them and burned them. And that one, they were gassing them. And we ran across that one. That was most horrible of all. You can't believe what it's like to see all those bodies. And it wasn't 10 bodies, it was thousands of them. And then they made the women of town come out and drag those bodies and bury them in a big slit trench. And you should have seen those howdy women, how they came out there wearing their high heels and their Beaufort hairdos. And they couldn't believe, you know, what they saw. But they knew. They had to smell it.
So they helped bury those bodies.
They made them bury them. And it was horrible. But those kind of things stick with you. It just shows you what kind of people we were up against. Those Nazis they're worse than animals. Animals don't treat their own that way.
Joe, one of the things that I heard you talk about was a particularly counter kind of a day. It was Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve of 1944 was the most blessed evening I ever saw. We were in a foxhole. My buddy McGee and me, McGee was from Texas, he and I were foxhole buddies. We were in a foxhole on a big hill. And this hill ran down about 200 or 300 yards on an open meadow, and you could see it kind of glistening. And down below was a big woods. In the woods were the Germans. We knew they were there. They knew we were up on the hill. And at 10 o'clock at night, the shooting was still going on everywhere. You could see fire in the air, and you could hear bursts of machine gun fire, everything. All of a sudden, as if on a signal, it all stopped. It got just so quiet that you can't believe it. And then the German soldiers started to sing their song, Christmas Tree, O Tannenbaum. And one or two started, and pretty soon there's hundreds of them singing that song. And then they went into Silent Night. They sang Silent Night in German. And we sat there, and it was so holy, I can't explain it to you. I cried like a baby. And, you know, when I came home, I played in a band. I play saxophone. I still have trouble playing that song. I break up when I try to play it. It's just something about it. Brings back a memory, and I can't help it. That was a holy, holy night.
And, Joe, I want to ask you about the end of the war, because they sent our troops home in order by how many points they had earned.
You had to have 70 points to go home right away. They had me down for 69, and I actually had 74. I had a gold leaf cluster to one of my bronze stars, and they hadn't registered it. So I could have gone home in July. Instead of that, I had to wait until December to get on a ship to get home.
Now, Joe, one of the other things I know you wanted to talk about was all throughout the war and in fighting across Europe, you didn't have food, you didn't have hot water, you were deprived of a lot of the basic things that we take for granted today. What would you like to tell our young people about that?
I would like the young people to know that every day be thankful for two things, especially hot water and electricity. You know, when we were growing up in the 30s, a lot of us didn't have that. There's outdoor toilets. There was pumps for water. And if your mom or dad had 15 cents to buy ice, you had some ice in an ice box. Be thankful for that. That's what we fought for. And if the Germans had won the war, I don't know what we'd have had. And just be thankful for it, because I am every day.
Joe, we're just about out of time. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
No, excepting, you know, I just enjoy doing this, and I just hope that it did some good. I hope somebody gets some ideas from it, and call me if you want to talk more.
And in an event like World War II, when we had to go to war and we had to put an end to the Holocaust and some other things, there's a cost to pay, isn't there?
The Holocaust was the main thing, and I'm glad we stopped that.
And freedom is not free.
No, it's not free.
Joe, thanks for joining us today and telling us about your experience in World War II. That was Joe Kovar, a member of General Patton's 3rd Army in World War II on Minnesota Military Radio. The war in Europe ended with an invasion of Germany by the Western Allies and the Soviet Union, culminating in the German unconditional surrender on May 8, 1945. Following the Potsdam Declaration by the Allies on June 26, 1945, and the refusal of Japan to surrender under its terms, the United States dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th and August 9th, respectively, which led to Japan's surrender. World War II was a global war that lasted from 1939 to 1945, though related conflicts began earlier. It involved the vast majority of the world's nations, including all of the great powers, eventually forming two opposing military alliances, the Allies and the Axis. It was the most widespread war in history, and directly involved more than 100 million people from over 30 countries. In a state of total war, the major participants threw their entire economic, industrial, and scientific capabilities behind the war effort, erasing the distinction between civilian and military resources. Marked by the mass deaths of civilians, including the Holocaust, during which approximately 11 million people were killed, it resulted in an estimated 50 to 85 million fatalities worldwide. These made World War II the deadliest conflict in human history. Thanks for listening to this edition of Minnesota Military Radio. I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this week, Bob Clemens, Vince Parker, Joe Kovar, Commissioner Larry Shelato of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and finally, Minnesota's Adjutant General, Major General Rick Nash. Please join us each week for another edition of Minnesota Military Radio on this station or online anytime at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com. I'm Tom Lyons, and I hope that you make a difference in someone's life this week.
Minnesota Military Radio is a production of iHeartMedia, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, the Minneapolis VA, Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and the Minnesota National Guard. Your host is Tom Lyons, founder and owner of Phelan Partners Limited, a merger and acquisition advisory firm. Tom is a life member of the American Legion, VFW, Vietnam Veterans of America, and the DAV. For podcasts and the latest updates, follow us at MinnesotaMilitaryRadio.com.